Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. I'm Jeff Huser. So, you know, FX Guide is a multi-city, multi-country operation. John Montgomery, the three founders are John Montgomery, who's based in Chicago, myself, who's based in Los Angeles, and Mike Seymour is based in Sydney, Australia. But it's been a real travel time lately with the start of the FX PhD term. I think we're in week six right now. We just finished break week, and week six, just we're in that right now as I record this. Before the term, they went to Japan to film some material for a class in this term with Stu Mashwitz using DSLRs. So anyway, that was the first trip of the kind of run that we had, and then we went to SIGGRAPH in New Orleans, all three of us, and we did a bunch of reporting there for FX Guide TV. In between all that, we launched FX Guide TV in Spanish, by the way. If you haven't seen that, check it out if that's of interest to you, and give us feedback. We've had a lot of great feedback on that, trying to branch out a little bit and do some native language versions of things. It's very exciting progression for us. Also, then I just got back from China, doing a little training trip over to Beijing, which was amazing. And John's on his way to IBC to cover to Amsterdam to cover IBC for us. So it's been crazy. It's been great. It's been very exciting travel time, and the FX PhD, the term's been going great. There's been just a lot of great classes coming out this term. So check it out over there. And then on to the business of the podcast. Today's podcast is with Peter Doyle about the Harry Potter films, Harry Potter, the latest film. Peter's has been the chief color scientist on the Lord of the Rings films and a lot of other great films. And we really wanted to go in depth and talk about color and color space and really a technical hardcore discussion of some of the issues faced in this. And this is the high end of the studio pipeline. This is obviously, you know, a major motion picture with all of the pressures and problems that you might assume with that. So as we always say at FX Guide and PhD, we always try to look at some of these high end things that maybe don't exactly apply to your situation, but often by looking at some of these best practices, we can learn things that apply all the way down the pipeline, all the way down the line to us and to doing the work that we do day to day. So let's join Mike Seymour as he talks with Peter Doyle about Harry Potter.
So let me start by saying thanks for joining us. Appreciate it. So this is your fourth Harry Potter film, as I understand it?
Yeah, actually it would be, yep.
And I wanted to see if we could discuss in some depth the way that you've approached the grading and sort of the sort of almost color scoring of the film, because I think the film looks absolutely terrific. What was your first approach? Do you like start with just what you receive in terms of the material? Do you read the book? Do you try and just talk to the DOP and the director? How do you approach the project?
Way beforehand, we'll work with the DP, and in the Harry Six case, it was Bruno Delbono, and production design and costume, to get a real feel for what everyone's hoping to get out of the sets and the production design, and also the costumes. A practical consideration is you tend to have a lot of kids wearing a lot of black and very dark sets with their capes. So, you know, sort of first day into it is always tricky just to work out how to give some kind of energy to that. So once the discussions have moved forward in terms of big picture, just what each set is hoping to evoke, or what kind of what everyone's hoping to get out of the production design from Stuart. And in terms of the costumes, you know, how detailed the fabrics are to be, certain color cues, extremely important. DP will work up their palette as to how they want to do this in terms of lighting. And at that point, there's quite a lot of technical discussions that start in terms of the choice of the film stocks, the print stock that we wish to use, and then based on that, we'll then look at the recording stock for the actual DI output. Working backwards, the print stock is kind of decided because one of the things with these scale of films is because of their day and date and large print runs, we're typically looking at around 23 to 26,000 prints, which, because of the day and date, need to be made around the world at the same time. So the printing of this film is much more of an industrial process than you would perhaps think of a smaller, say, independent film where you might be trying to do some lab work in terms of bleach bypass or something a little more chemical orientated. So what we do is to ensure that the labs can be given a negative that they can print with minimal intervention.
So presumably you did multiple sort of printer negs because you had the opportunity obviously to run out multiple negs as opposed to doing one neg and running interpos and internegs on them. So how many negs would you have run out on a film like this?
Well, it's a combo because there's a thing called versioning, and that's a film like this actually exists in around 33 versions in terms of language that's overdubbed or language that's subtitled, and then inserts that are retitled. So if there's a newspaper that will be put into the foreign language of that country. So having built up this matrix of you know, the various versions and how that what exactly that version is, whether it's an audio question, at that point we're just using the original version of the film, or a subtitled or an insert film, that will then work out whether it's a inner pause or an inner neg, or we can in fact supply a DI neg. So in this case, we made around 10 DI negs for North America and around, I think, 4 DI negs for Europe, then 2 interpols, and then around 30 internegs.
And what stock did yourself and Bruno and David end up agreeing on?
Shooting stock was almost exclusively Kodak 5218. The recording stock was the Fuji RDI. The dupe stock was the Fuji CDI. And then the prints were the Kodak 83, so the Kodak Vision, using Technicolor chemistry worldwide for
right.
The releases.
So you're famous for the work you did with pioneering the Colorfront, or a sort of a custom-built version of the Colorfront software. Are you still using that, or what are you actually grading on that? What's your preferred tool?
Yeah, I moved off the Colorfront or the Autodesk software probably about 4 years ago. So I've been using the Baselite for the last few films, which I've had Filmlight help out by building a different interface to it that sort of matches how I want to work, and a lot more plugins and some other just bits and pieces in terms of color control.
So I believe that you are still on the Luster or the Colorfront for King Kong, is that right? And then you moved, what, for Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, or was it the Goblet of Fire?
Well, in order of events, I think Harry 3 was on a Colorfront build. Harry 4 was on a color build. Then we rebuilt the facility and moved on to Baselite for Harry 5. But then I did King Kong with a Autodesk build of Luster, and then Golden Compass, I did with a E-Works build of Luster, and then the Harries have been base lights. Yeah, I think that's how it's worked out.
And this film has like a kind of reduced color palette with a lovely tonality to it. What was your approach in that sort of reduced color palette? I presume that was what you're referring to. You had that always from the outset in terms of wardrobe and set design.
Yeah, well, it's Bruno, the DP, was very keen to investigate some very specific color motifs, and the sort of general principle was to shoot with wide lenses, you know, typically from about 16 to 20 mils. So basically have the angle of view of a wide lens, but the depth of field of a long lens. So in fact, in all shots of the film, we rebuilt the depth of focus.
Oh, really?
So it's probably not that apparent, because I mean it's not something you'd necessarily react to instantly, but if you look at the film, you'll see that the foreground to background focus ratios is completely different, and that most of the background is softened as opposed to blurred, and in the process that will change the color and the saturation, because as we all know, as you blur an image, you kind of reduce the dynamic range. So by going into the film that way, in terms of just saying, well, let's kind of mix the lenses that we're used to, because the grammar of cinema that we're kind of used to, if we see a wide shot, we're kind of used to it being completely in focus, and if we see like a long shot, we're used to seeing the background out of focus. And you could say that that's almost a cue of what the shots are, because particularly now with the modern lenses, Bruno went with the Cork S4s, you know, their distortion is quite minimal between the short and the long, but the depth of focus, I mean, because that's just mathematically how lenses are, you can't change that. So mixing that around, we ended up with a very interesting concept, and that's rather than changing the color and the density of the film by, in fact, changing the density, we thought it would be far more attractive to let the contrast and the density and the color be changed based on the depth of focus. So you'll have actors, you know, maybe through, because the thing is that, you know, this is a cast-driven film in terms of there's an ensemble. You've almost always got three kids on the screen, and it's widescreen. So that tends to dictate shooting things reasonably in focus. But if you look at any of your shots, you'll find that the backgrounds are typically far more diffused and out of focus than, in fact, they are, as captured by the lens. So that made for a very interesting concept, because it meant that we could grade for the foreground, knowing that the background would in fact have a significantly reduced contrast.
But Peter, let me ask you this: on a shot that had a virtual background, obviously a castle virtual background that was put in CG, I presume you could get mattes, but on shots where you couldn't get mattes, did you have a team of rotos supporting you, and how did you actually manage to so well define the foreground from the midground and the background?
Well, we basically rotoscope it, and it's no secret these films take their time to grade.
Sure.
But no, it's just myself and a second colorist, Noel Kanglin, and we basically sit there and rotoscope it. And the thing is, you don't necessarily need the articulated mats that you need to, say, you know, separate and do a true comp. I mean, we're talking far more generic kind of shapes, so it's much more like the more, it'd be more like the old days of working in a dark room where, you know, you're dodging and burning. Because the thing is, if you actually did a super tight articulated mat, it would actually draw attention to itself. So we were, the depth of focus that we were doing was based far more on a plane of focus, if you will.
Right.
So it wasn't necessarily just drawing around the actor. It would be finding a vanishing point in the shot or finding some piece of set construction and drawing there. Because the thing is, if you walk on set or walk around with the set painters, they are, in fact, doing exactly the same thing. The backdrops, I mean, if you ever walk on a set and look at a backdrop, obviously it's completely shocking to see just how little detail there actually is in there. But that's the whole trick of, you know, set painting and set design. So in a bizarre way, we're just taking that a little further. So, you know, Stuart, our production designer, and Bruno would sit here and we would, in fact, define what should or should not be, you know, out of focus, and then use that as the cue to then maybe grad it even further or so forth. The other thing is, this was a reasonably studio-based film, which meant that we could shoot most of the film within the studio that we have in the UK. And on the lot, we've built a very large grading room, which is it's the presentation room for visual effects, it's the rushes room for review of rushes every day, and it's also the main DI room. So that would mean that Bruno could shoot, say, on day one, or do a quick test with an egg end of day one, and we could have it in the DI room the next morning, grade it and do whatever test grades that we needed, so that then Bruno could hit the shoot knowing how it's actually going to react.
Actually, it seems to me that would be a great opportunity for you to be able to present the visual effect shots in the context of the sort of grade that you intended to put on them.
Correct. Part of the whole thing is that the second tier to this sort of process is that the visual effects are color managed. So by building all this work during the rushes model, we're able to copy the grades across to the DI to the visual effects. So in fact, anybody working on the Harry films will receive their scans, but they can then go to a website where they can download values that will show where basically they're grading values, not grading references because of security and so forth. It'd be a little dangerous to put stuff up on the web, but
sure.
Basically, so for example, Rising Sun in Adelaide and Sydney, you can go to this website, download the values for every scan that they have, and if they plug in these numbers, they know that that's the exposure value that we want that shot to be. So when that shot has its visual effects added and then it's presented back to us, we can, in fact, just copy the pre-built grade that we've been working on onto that, and it'll work, which then means that daily, for the visual effects reviews, we can carry a conform of the film with the latest cut and just plug in, you know, the daily delivered shots. They'll inherit the working grade at the time and the working cut, so the team can basically see the visual effects in context and graded, specifically the last big scene of Harry and Dumbledore in the cave is, you know, from a grading viewpoint, very complicated because Bruno really lit it with one light. He really did just have a very large 5K in a China ball and just moved it around. So it was lit with one light. So, and, you know, it's a whole combo of green screen, CGI and so forth. So to build that and not destroy the visual effects, but then likewise in that case for ILM to know where to actually light this thing and to build it and to match their CG lighting to the foreground lighting, everyone kind of needs to know where this thing's going.
And just in the specific, when you say they plug in the numbers, do you mean that you export a sort of a 3D LUT from the True Light I mean, when in the specific, is it a 3D LUT that you're handing out to those effects companies that they would look up on the net?
Yeah, specifically, no. I'm really not a big fan of 3D LUTs because it just destroys the image. So what we do is all the vendors will receive the raw scan. We will present sets of numbers. One set of numbers are simply a red, green, and blue gain.
And, oh, really?
And that simply is like a primary grade. So that will just set the exposure but maintain the contrast ratio. So that's what we call the neutral grade. So it means that everything is still there and it hasn't been twisted by any like 3D LUTs or so forth.
Right.
So then the vendors can plug in all their work knowing that this is the exposure it's to be. Then they have a second set of numbers which they can use for their monitoring, which will show how much the shot will be typically printed down. Now for Harry 6, because Bruno's a very consistent DP and how things worked out, we were able to build the entire film knowing that all the visual effects will be printed down one stop,
mm-hmm.
which meant that the effects were built basically with a one-stop latitude. So if we in the DI then needed to get in and start moving the blacks around or wanting to do something with the highlights, that latitude was there. And the irony of all of this is that that's taking back the visual effects concept back to the days of the opticals, and in fact returning to the concept of what DI was, which is a digital intermediate, which was a replacement to a chemical dupe, where if you made a dupe, you typically had one stop versus the camera neg. So you in fact made a photographic copy of the camera neg, but to retain all the grain value and detail in the blacks, you would in fact give that one stop when getting across to the dupe, which is where all this black defined at 95 and so forth has come into it, because there still seems to be a lot of confusion in the industry about that world. So basically, if you're a vendor, you'll get the scan, you'll get these numbers which you'll plug in. That's where you can build the visual effects. Basically, that means that the shot's looking a little bright, but that effectively is matching the scan of, say, the original drama shot, as in this kind of typical running with two-thirds to a one-stop exposure, and then the second set of lights, knowing that this is in principle how it will look printed down.
Do you like to have your neg scanned at 4K and then run through 2K in the pipeline, or what's your preferred way of working with the scanner?
Yeah, it depends on the scanner and the lens. For these films, or typically any of the UK films I've been grading, I work with Finisite in London. I've got a couple of North lights who are looking really good. We had the lenses changed when we started. The actual scanning lens itself had some aberration or whatever, but they're being tweaked up. So they run with a 4K and down to 2, and that their down res and up res is tuned quite well. It's pretty good because it's spent a lot of time getting it, so it's balanced across the channels. One of the things that I think you've got to be quite careful about scanning, because if you don't do it the right way, you basically just end up with really sharp grain rather than a sharp image.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that we, as part of the DI grade, spend a lot of time banking in a lot of maybe sharpening and graining as part of the actual DI grade, so that the actual record out process is effectively unity. Because once we're getting into multiple negatives, we'll say in this case use Technicolor North Hollywood for multiple record outs as well. So again, going back to that industrial concept, you need to make sure that the grade itself is transferable, that you can't have a film recorder to kind of fancy in terms of it's tweaked up, because you may well be using multiple facilities.
While you do testing, I also believe that the level of color management that you've managed to apply to these films mean that you've moved past just wedging and offering a few clips to vendors and actually have much tighter control on that that whole process. Is that right?
Yeah. Philosophically, we have banned lightbox and film print as the idea of clips because they don't work. And the bizarre reality of sending film clips as a color reference is dangerous, because it is very rare that those film clips would ever be pulled from a fully timed print. They would typically have been from a rush's print, which, you know, may not necessarily be, I mean, it's probably close to what the DP had in mind, but, you know, it still rushes. So that's like a pretty big variable, number one. And then number two is that you're asking everyone to run on a light box. And, you know, the idea of a light box being an international
calibrated
standard,
source.
It's just not going to work. I mean, it is, you know, it's supposed to be 5, and it's interesting, the DIN standard is in fact 5,000, and it's 78 Candela. But the thing is, you know, you fire up any of the modern day calibration packages and they immediately default to, you know, at least 80 and 54K. So all of a sudden, you know, you're 400 Kelvin off just by switching the thing on. So our philosophy is to just get rid of all that stuff completely and to remove any concept of interpretation. Because, you know, in terms of visual effects integration, we need all the vendors. We want to give all the vendors everything that they need to be able to get on with what they do well, which is, in fact, visual effects and compositing and so forth. We don't necessarily need, you know, several facilities around the world interpreting via their own personal light box a clip that may or may not have been, you know, plus or minus a point on the day that it was made, you know, basically interpreting their reading of an image on a light box and then building a manual lookup table on a monitor, even assuming that their monitor is in fact in the right place, because that conversion, basically you could say, or philosophically, if you're asking a facility to convert between formats, that will involve some creative interpretation. And it's at that point that it can get a little wacky, because the idea of having multiple facilities be able to creatively interpret exactly the same way is just not going to happen. So what we've done is just remove that completely and just say, here are the scans and here are the numbers. And even if your monitors, frankly, that, you know, are nothing like ours, it doesn't actually matter, because you know, the decisions that they're having to make and the effort and expertise that they're bringing to the table in terms of, you know, the best shaders on the planet and the best, you know, matte extractions and so forth, then become independent of whether their monitoring matches our monitoring.
Yep.
And it just makes things a lot easier. And I do gather, I mean, it's been interesting. It's been almost, it gets a little depressing, but it's almost a decade now of working this way. And certainly there was extraordinary resistance in the early days from various parties to embrace this concept. But over the last half decade, we have found that there's a great deal of support for this, because it means that, say, the poor senior compositor who's sitting in a room and he's just been told he's got this 40-shot sequence and here's his little team of compositors, you can just see the guy's eyes dilate, working out, well, how on earth is he going to keep control on all this stuff? You know, in terms of color, you know, because you got one guy down the back in the corner, really dark, and you got another guy up front, but, you know, he's near the window with his flat screen, which hasn't actually been replaced. And so, you know.
Let me change gears with you for a second, because I wanted to get onto some of the creative stuff, and I don't want to consume too much of your time. And David Yates has been very, obviously, complimentary of the work that you and Bruno have done. And discuss the DOP in terms of it being very layered and incredibly rich. But I understand that you, from an interview with David, that you actually had sort of two passes at this. You did a whole version, and then after some discussion with David in the studio, you went back and kind of simplified your colour philosophy. Is that right?
Certainly there was an evolution in terms of the overall design. And yeah, I mean, there's always many passes on a film. One of the processes of doing a DI this way, where it's part of the production, as in you set up an editorial department and you set up a color department, it's an evolution, and it's almost a little matrix. If you grade, you know, scenes 1, 2, and 3, 6, and 7 this way, and then grade reel 4 this way, it might push the other scenes to maybe need another look just to get some kind of consistency, and also once the film settles in. So the film really does go through quite a evolution.
It seemed to me, then, looking at the film, and I say I admire it tremendously, there was almost a halation, or I'm not going to say a glow, but almost a halation with some of the characters and some of the scenes. Was there any kind of processing like that, or was I just imagining that?
No, what you've picked up on is a very interesting thing, and that's to talk technical for a second. Print stocks have got about as sharp as you'll ever get a print stock, mm-hmm. as far as I can tell, unless we start spending a lot more money and having a lot more silver put back into the prints, and you know that's not going to happen. The film recorders, you could say, have probably got as sharp as you'll get. We've seen a great advance with the RDI neg that's given us a little extra in the blue and so forth. So you could say, just at the moment, the film chain as we know it in a decent cinema, you know, like a modern, mm-hmm. modern theater, is, you know, it is actually really sharp. Along the way, everyone has actually got used, I think, to looking at their own imagery. And, you know, worldwide, you know, the film manufacturers have seen a significant reduction in basically the amount of imagery that's going to paper. So most people these days, in fact, will take their happy snaps with their little digital cameras and look at it either on you know, the iPhones or whatever, or in fact their computer screen. It's not that often that they get printed out. So, and those images are so sharp, you know, it's much sharper than anything you would ever see in a cinema. And then this is where the philosophy comes in. I think that's taken over the definition of when an image looks real from what it used to be, say, a decade ago, when if it was shot with a video camera and a bit of handheld, it was news, so therefore it must be real. Because District 9 worked with that superbly. You know, it created a complete construct, totally synthetic, but has made it feel real by working in that visual language. So the thing with, you know, the world of Hogwarts is the emotions we wanted to evoke was something a little more romantic and a little more storybook, and something that we hoped would stay in your mind a little longer. And one of the interesting things we noticed last year on a film was actually Charlie and the Chocolate Factory with Tim Burton. One of the things we really noticed is we would run the DCI version of the film, and then we'd run a print version of the film, you know, and it's all color now, so it's all fine. But we kind of noticed the next day that, in fact, the print version stuck in your head more. There was just a sense of memory because it's something that's actually being projected. And it was that concept that we really wanted to experiment with on the Harry 6, and that's how can we make an image that you will remember more, or that you will emotionally embrace a little more and not take it as doco or real, and therefore possibly a little throwaway. The immediate kind of reaction to that would be, well, make it look old. You know, so it's like old and romantic, and so that immediately would say, you know, drop a vignette, blur it, and then make the whole thing sepia, so it looked like an old photo. But that's obviously a cliche. But along the way was, if we look at a lot of photos that people find attractive, say, for example, the Polaroids, they're not really sharp, to say the least, but they're sharp in another way. So what I built, basically, was we just blurred the hell out of the entire film. Like, this film is, like, unbelievably soft. But then sharpened the things that we felt should be sharp. So, you know, sparkle in eyes, details in clothes. So the end result is that the film was treated completely with a diffusion, but it's a type of diffusion that you would perhaps be more used to in the older days of going out to, if you're doing print work, as in lithography. If you ever see like an image on a screen before it actually gets printed, it's amazing how noisy and sharp it actually is. But then when it hits the print, because the actual paper itself is doing this kind of really wacky filtering and blurring, it makes the image look very attractive. So it's that type of filtering that we applied to the whole film, which in technical terms meant we just rebuilt the MTF of the lens. We really just reshaped it so that it reacted more like a lens where the color coatings had been pulled off, which a lot of DPs still do. You know, they prefer the older style primos or to grab an old Ingenieur or something like that, yeah, compared to the Arri primes. But obviously to do that brings in other issues, one of which is finding them matched, and B, you're committing that to the neg, and that's a little... I don't think any studio is ever going to let you do that on a major film.
So was that what was giving it the sort of tonality and the skin tones? Because it was a gorgeous sort of feeling to the skin tones of the characters, albeit them not necessarily, you know, a typical beauty defocus softness, but I mean even Dumbledore skin or whatever, there's almost a luster, a sort of a increased subsurface scattering, I can't really describe it, that we're seeing in the skin tones. Or is that more just to do with the lighting and the overall grade?
It's both, because once we kind of zeroed in on this kind of, it's a plug-in, it's not commercially available, but it's something we built internally, which we just run on the film line. I mean, you can do it on anything, frankly, it's processing. But once we zeroed that in, and I mean, we ended up calling it the Bruno Gone, you know, button. But Bruno was able to adjust his lighting, so basically Bruno reduced his contrast ratio on the neg, so that meant, because again, with diffusion and blurs and all these things, it's completely reliant on contrast ratio, because that's basically what it's doing. So once Bruno had a feel for how this thing would actually work, you know, we felt that if we actually reduced the contrast ratio just slightly and had maybe a 4-to-1 or 5-to-1 shadow to key, rather than the extreme high con that you can get out of these modern stocks, that this filtering would in fact react a lot better. So it was a combo. The other thing, and the other thing that you're seeing with the skin tone is just by being able to do that as part of the DI and the digital squeeze, basically you can afford to have just slightly more grain in your original neg than perhaps, you know, you could get away with before. But one of the things is we were able to just lower the amount of light on set, which just means that the skin just reacts a whole lot better than having like a screaming great HMI, you know, just really burning into the skin. So that allowed for the skin itself to just react a lot better to the lighting. And Bruno had the confidence to do that because he was actually, you know, he was able to see this whole process as you go and then kind of tweak back and forth. So the other thing that you're probably reacting to in that film is that rather than just manipulate a 1D lookup table in terms of, you know, the just changing the blacks and the contrast, we tended to keep the contrast ratio the same for the entire film, knowing that Bruno was lighting for that contrast ratio. So you could say that if we had removed the DI process and we were just printing this as like a lab style film, we'd created a pipeline that was doing the equivalent of reducing the gamma of the print by about 0.2, which is fine. It just means we're running with a slightly lower con. But rather than do that with gamma and 1D lookup tables, which completely screw up your saturation and your chroma, it changes the relationship.
Yeah.
We spend a lot of time basically just using tone mapping and local area contrast adjustments. So basically, in sheer technical language, rather than adjust gamma or move a 1D lookup table, we would use tone mapping instead.
That's fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. Because, I mean, it really does... I think what's interesting about it is you're almost defining a new filmic look that isn't relying on a retrograde solution, but by the same token is sort of trying to be, for want of a better term, filmic, if that's fair to say.
Well, yeah, I mean, the bizarre thing with DI is that if you look at, you know, the standard DI tool set, it's basically three tracker balls that adjust a 1D lookup table, and you go, well, whoever said that that's what we need to, in fact, color grade a film? And then you go, well, that's what we've always done. And you go, well, hang on, well, why is that there? Then you go, well, in the old days of the ranks and so forth, the CRTs were what they were, you know, and that they needed constant adjustments and realigning. So the best way to do that would be to supply, you know, these 1D lookup tables. So you've got this bizarre thing that color grading has been defined as basically being a 1D lookup table jockey, which, you know, to me it's not particularly subtle, to say the least. Whereas if you look at the heyday of film optical works, particularly in the really early days of Douglas Trumbull and Richard Edlund, and, you know, all the gurus with Apogee and those companies, and even Greenberg, you know, when they were going mad with their optical printers, the stuff they were getting into was just absolutely amazing. And certainly we can do it now digitally with less noise, and we can do it cleaner. But they were doing a lot of things there that were, I think, filmically very interesting. And even in Sydney with the old days with Mirage, you know, when Andrew Mason and that crowd was running around, you know, if you, in fact, George Miller wanted that on Lorenzo's Oil, you wanted, you know, the Cineon was just not... You know, they were still gaffer taping the blue laser into the recorder. It just wasn't quite ready for that. But if you wanted a desaturated image, you could shoot the camera neg, strike a black and white IP, marry the two together in an optical printer, and then just mix between the two. And then all of a sudden you had this fantastic, you know, black and white color, desat mix, and... you know, because
which
the black
of course
and white
most people from a digital world don't even realize that when you're color timing a film in the old days, the one thing you didn't have was saturation control.
Correct, but in fact, you in fact did.
Yes, yes. Yeah. I'm sorry, you did in the real sense, but yes, at the superficial level, you didn't, yeah.
Because, I mean, even on this film for the final prints, you know, we're running the digital negative certain LED value and running our prints at a particular LED level that actually gave, that meant that the window of the gamut of the color print really matched where the DI was sitting, so all this interlayer effect and all that kind of stuff meant that we were getting the maximum chroma on the print. Or, but in another language, we were using as much silver as we could in the print and not just basically, you know, washing it out. So it's quite interesting. So it's more about, I think, just applying more kind of global tweaks or filters to an image rather than diving in on every individual shot and then working it to death. And I think by approaching it that way, you know, if one is fortunate to work with, you know, the really top-end DPs who can turn in very consistent negative where it's been shot with that look in mind, I think it can get very interesting to basically approach it with, I'll do a lab-style grade where basically all the shots match with each other. And, you know, so now this runs perfectly. And, in fact, for a couple of scenes, we got completely lost. We got way too fancy and far too clever for ourselves. So, you know, it's a standard moment. I've done it a lot with Andrew Lesney as well on Rings. It's just sometimes you can get way too clever. So we just hit reset and we just turbocharge as fast as you can a classic film lab style grade where you're just adjusting printer lights and just getting a really good looking neg, where, you know, an image where you're interpreting okay, this needs to be a little bright here and then we should bring it down here. And then on top of that, apply all this kind of fancy processing. And
I imagine, in the case of Andrew, and as the case with Bruno, they were providing you with a pretty fat negative in the first place, in the sense that they really gave you that consistency to work through across the film.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of night scenes, in fact, where we did some testing and it just made a lot more sense to, in fact, push the neg two stops in the lab.
Wow.
So a couple of night scenes where we wanted really soft blacks, which were being shot at night, it was like the practical considerations meant, well, obviously, if you can run around set with a film stock rated at 1600, that's going to be a lot better for your gaffer than standing there with something at like 500 for a start. But, you know, along the way, that means that you get a lot softer blacks. You do actually get more detail in there. It's not necessarily detail that you'd want to print up or work that you would, say, with a stock running normally, but it does gives a very nice kind of softness to it, which means you don't even have to start doing anything in the DI. It's already there.
So that was 500 rated at 1600, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, although it's, in this case, the 18 was rated at 320, so then push the two stops. And then, obviously, you have to be a little careful because no lab, when it pushes, is really exactly two stops. You know, depending on the lab, it could be 1.5 or you know, 1.75.
But presumably those night scenes wanted to be dark anyway, so that was working for you. I mean, it wasn't
exactly
like you're trying to see everything. The whole point of them was that they were dark.
Yeah.
Look, it's been absolutely fascinating talking to you. I can't thank you enough for taking the time to go into such detail with us. We really do appreciate it.
Okay, well, thank you.
Am I allowed to ask if you're scheduled in for the remaining Potter films?
Yeah, I think, I'm standing in the grading theatre now. We're in day 112 of a 200-day shoot.
I can't wait to see the end result. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Great. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Mike and Peter, for that discussion. Very interesting. That'll do it for this FX podcast. For my partners, Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, this is Jeff Huser saying thanks for listening.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2008 FX Guide LLC.
Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.